Do you know someone with a drug or alcohol problem? Get help right now. Insurance may cover everything. Stop the drug and alcohol nightmare. Are drug and alcohol problems hitting you too close to home? Get help right now. Insurance may cover everything.
800-210-7907. 800-210-7907. 800-210-7907. That's 800-210-7907.
Those of us in the law enforcement profession know how important good and effective interview and interrogation skills are. And sometimes we fall flat, and this can cost us a case, our reputation to ourselves and the department, and ultimately it can and will affect the relationship with the community. My next guest you're going to love. His name is Brian Leslie. He is a coercive interrogation expert and a former chief of police. He's also the owner of Criminal Case Consultants. Now, Brian has examined many felony cases in more than 45 of the 50 states just in the last 3 years, providing forensic reports and testimony. And Brian says this: identifying patterns of racial targeting, flawed investigations, excessive use of coercive and interrogation techniques that force questionable confessions, coercive interview methods that use narrative integration to extract favorable witness statements, and faulty processes IDing suspects is unfortunately common in the law enforcement profession. Many officers and police departments across America do take their oath seriously with pride and perform their sworn duty flawlessly. We all know this. These officers work every day in their communities with no incidents and do make a difference. Most of these officers are seldomly in the media and maintain virtual anonymity, but unfortunately wear a negative stain from those officers that fail their communities with bad interrogation techniques. You're going to love this very informative interview with the one and only Brian Leslie. Next on the CJ Evolution podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Patrick here, host and creator. Thank you for tuning in. We know you got many options, a lot of podcasts out there, and we're always appreciative of you spending a little bit of your valuable time with us. Sharing it with your family and friends makes us the top-ranked podcast that we are. If you love the content, head over to Apple Podcasts. Give us that 5-star rating. We sure would appreciate it. I want to give a big shout-out, like I always do, to the brave men and women working in the criminal justice field. Wherever you're at, whatever you're doing, thank you for doing it. You're doing a job that most won't or can't, and we love you for it. Remember, you were honored and cherished, and keep doing the fantastic job that you're doing. We will get through this, and we'll be stronger and more resilient. Folks, if you love coffee, you know what I'm about to say. I'm a huge fan of the company Four Sigmatic. I have been for a couple of years. I love all their products, from coffees to elixirs to cocos. They have it all. I am a huge fan of Lion's Mane Mushroom Coffee. Yes, you heard me right. Mushrooms, the good mushrooms, not the bad mushrooms. And it tastes better than regular coffee. Gives me the energy, the clarity I need, the extra zip that I need to get me through the day. You are going to love their products. And best of all, you're going to get 15% off of your purchases using the promo code CJEVO. Head over to CJEvolution.com, see the link to Four Sigmatic, and you will not be disappointed. It's such an honor to be partnered with Detecticam, an amazing and innovative company that's helping keep our first responders and military personnel safer by offering mobile threat detection that fits in the palm of their hands, identifying illicit drugs, explosives, now COVID-19. The technology is amazing. It's all app-based, and I wish we had this technology when I was a young officer, but you can have it now. This is must-needed equipment for your agency. Head over to CJEvolution.com, see the link to Detecticam, and see how they can help keep your troops safer.
Are you tired of high cable TV rates? Sign up for Dish today and get a $500 bonus offer while supplies last. Plus, lock in your price for 2 years guaranteed. Call All American Dish, your Dish authorized retailer now.
800-471-0253. 800-471-0253. That's 800-471-0253.
Offers require credit qualification, 24-month commitment, early termination fee, and e-auto pay. Restrictions apply. Call for details.
This is such an informative interview with the one and only Brian Leslie. You're going to love it, and it's going to help you up your game with interrogation techniques. Now, the beginning of this interview was somehow not recorded with my equipment, but we start off fairly quickly from the start of the interview. Enjoy this great and informative episode with Brian Leslie.
Departments are doing right, but you know what? No one's ever going to tell them this because they're not going to be on the news tonight. Is the fact is there's so many officers that are doing so much community-based policing in the communities. They know their communities well. They know the people they're policing, and these are assets to any police department. And one of the things that when I was policing myself, one of the things that I prided myself in is knowing everybody in my community that I was policing, knowing everybody in my district, knowing everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, I would spend time when I wasn't in the patrol car walking around getting to know people, because that down the road, that's a 2-year investment when you do that. Mm-hmm. You get to know everybody, they give you information. They're exactly. very, very, the unfortunate thing, and what's happening today is, unfortunately, we have a lot of technology. That's probably what's happening today. And the problem is there's the very few that do things that basically hurt others that are doing their job properly. And in my opinion, and I mean, as an interrogations techniques expert, I deal mainly with the defense side. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at cases that are all from the Defense of the Public Defender's Office, state, federal, and military, which I deal with all three of them. But one of the things that I always say, and even when I'm testifying, and I make a point of saying this because one of the most important things I think is important, just because I'm on the stand talking about what they did wrong in the interrogation room, I make a point of saying, you know what? Everything in this interview is 100% legal and done right. But what happens is bad choices are being made. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. And because that's where,
go ahead, Brian.
That's where it gets to a point where, you know, and I say to them that you should have asked certain questions. You should have done this, just one or two questions. All you needed to do was establish this. I wouldn't be here today.
Yeah. And there's a lot of good officers out there, just to preface that. Yeah. And the majority of, I think, our officers are doing a good job, but unfortunately there's officers out there that just bring a bad name to the good officers. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. You know what? There's so many unsung heroes out there that by the time people look at, and it takes a few to ruin a village, and you walk, you know, the community policing is a great community. And the problem is that there's a few that don't get it. They don't get what their purpose is. They go in with the wrong idea of what their job is. And their job title may be police officer, but first and foremost, you're serving your community.
Absolutely. Now let's get into the meat of the interview. And
sure, yeah.
Let's talk about confessions and interrogation interviews.
Sure.
Why do people, because we see it, I saw it in my career, not a lot, thank God. Maybe you've seen it more than I do. Why do people confess to crimes that they didn't commit? And I've seen this a handful of times in my career, Brian. Why do people do that?
Well, there's a couple of schools of thought on that. One of the reasons is the most obvious one, which is the fact is they like the attention. Mm-hmm. These are people that have very low self-esteem. They go in and they want to be attributed. They see the news. They see them flashing the suspects on the news every night. They want that attention. For some reason, it's a psychological thing. They don't get the attention when they were younger. And you'll find with, if you go back to these people, you'll see that their whole entire lives were like that. That
sure.
They were this class clown at school, perhaps, or they were the center of attention all the time. And this is all the more reason why officers in the interrogation room need to take extra liberties and make sure that this isn't the case.
Now, the one thing that you mentioned earlier, I want to kind of circle back around with Brian, is as you said, witnesses. I remember being a patrol officer, being a detective. I'm kind of with you. I mean, I never, it's not that I didn't believe a witness,
But I know that many different factors would come into play when it comes to, you know, witnesses IDing people and stuff like that. They come in with their own motives sometimes. The perception is off. You know, how do so many of these faulty IDs of suspects occur? I mean, is it just what I said? I mean, just perceptions and biases and stuff like that?
Well, actually, you know, in the wrongful identifications, I wrote an article called The Dominant Witness Theory. Mm-hmm. And the dominant witness theory, and you can find it online, I have a specific website for it. The dominant witness theory is the idea that when you go a multi-witness event and officers appear on a multi-witness event, one of the things the officers first asked any witness is, what did you see? What they shouldn't be asking, or what they should be asking, is, who did you speak to before I arrived? I used to
That's
do this
a good,
all the time.
That's a great point.
Yeah. Who did you speak to? Because one of the things that happens on multi-witnesses events is the dominant witness will integrate their narrative into the body of the subordinate witnesses. I used to take them out all the time. I used to separate them.
Yeah.
And I used to make them feel comfortable. I used to say, look, you know what? I'm going to talk to you a little bit on the side here. I used to sometimes even just lie about it. I'd say, look, you know, I don't believe the truth was, and I bet you know what the real color of the car was. I really believe that. I think you were better off in a position to see what the color. Now, I want you just to tell me, what color the car was, what you think it was. I'm not going to tell anybody else. I know you talked to the other witnesses. You guys had a conversation long before I got there. Almost 70% of the time, I'll get a different color. And okay, now we get. Now, I've done a lot of research into this. I'll tell you something. What I used to do is I've done probably about 32 lectures with more than 30, 35 people in a room. And one of the things I used to do is before they even come in the room, I put up three silhouettes of mugshots, basically, of three different guys. And what I would do is then I'd walk in the room and first I'd let them sit there for about 10, 15 minutes and nobody's really talking about it, but they're looking it up on the overhead. Then I'd come in and I'd turn it off and I'd say, and then I start appealing to their egos. And I'd say, how many here think they're amazing at recall? And of course, everybody wants to be amazing at recall. So you get 50% of the hands will go up.
Yeah, yeah.
I bet you, and I'll say, I bet you nobody in this particular room saw in suspect number two the tattoo on the right side of his neck in a hexagon shape. Now, what have I just done? I put in the description where it is. I've fed them the information. You wouldn't believe. I'll have six hands go up. Then I'll leave. I'll say, I got to take a call. I'll be right back. And I'll leave the room. And then I'll come back about 10 minutes later, and all of a sudden, eight more remembered, coincidentally. Hmm. And I'll do this again in maybe about half an hour. We'll talk about something else, totally unrelated. And then I'll go back and say, you know what? You guys are just amazing. You're just incredible. I don't know how you guys remembered that, but I bet you nobody in this room would be able to tell me what the image was inside the tattoo. And I'll make an excuse. I'll leave the room again for about 10. And I'll hear them talking amongst each other, arguing. And I'll come back in. And lo and behold, they now have exactly the image in the middle. And they'll describe it to me almost in detail. Mm-hmm. Then at the end of the thing, what I'll say to them is, okay, I'm going to take down these. I'm going to put back up these images again. I want you all to take a look at suspect number two. Where's the tattoo? There is none. There's never been a tattoo. Then they'll sit there and literally argue with me that in fact I put up a different silhouette.
Interesting.
That's in an hour and a half. I've just integrated a narrative into them that they now believe, and they totally will not, and they really believe they saw that.
Yeah.
So the dominant witness does exactly that. They'll argue and belittle the subordinate witness into this type of thing. And this is why when officers go on the multi-witness scene, they need to go in and vet and find out who the dominant witness is through the other witnesses.
Yeah, who they talk to first, like you said.
Exactly, exactly. And that's how your false identifications happen.
Yeah. And we, I know that, you know, police officers are human. They make mistakes. I know that there's investigations that go wrong. But I got to ask you, I mean, you're the expert, Brian. I mean, how can people, how can police get to a point where they're charging the wrong people? I mean, I was always raised in law enforcement that you're just going to go where the evidence leads you. You know, evidence, people lie. Evidence, okay. Evidence doesn't lie. But just explain that to people.
Okay. So what you're saying is what you believe, you follow the evidence. Okay. Now, let's.
Well, in most cases, yes.
I know, but let's say that in goodwill, the officer's following the evidence. Mm-hmm. What does he believe is the evidence? When you interviewed the witness, did you vet the witness's credibility? Mm-hmm. Did you vet the reasons for the witness coming forward? Did you vet the information and corroborate it with physical?
So it's pulling evidence? Back that extra layer and doing the extra
yes.
work.
Yes, okay. And the problem is, in good faith, officers think they have the right evidence because mm-hmm. we know in the police community that police officers believe, and let's face it, we all have egos when we're in the police community, that we've been around long enough that we know what's right and what's wrong. We know who's telling the truth, who's not. We kind of believe that we're kind of like a lie detector to a certain mm-hmm. degree. That gives you a false sense of who you think you're targeting. And how many times when you were in policing, did you say to yourself, look, I just know this guy's dealing. I just know.
I never said that, Brian. No, I'm just kidding. I and, did, yes.
But the one thing, you when you've got that said in your mind, now you have a predisposition.
Exactly.
It's like the guy that goes in to, let's say, a domestic, and he just hates the idea of women getting victimized by males. So you go into the apartment with your partner, and you're watching this guy just acting like a total ass, and he's yelling and he's screaming but what you're doing is you're misinterpreting that as something else. He may be angry at the fact she called the police.
Yeah.
You're taking that as a fact he's angry and violent.
Yeah.
And because you have a predisposition, you're not going to be open to listening to reason or excuse. What you're going to do, and one of the things you're not going to do almost 100% of the time, is question the victim.
Yeah.
And one of the things I do in my job is I question victims. I question their credibility. I vet their credibility. I vet the purpose why they were there in the first place. That's why I reverse engineer from the interrogation backwards. I don't go forwards. And I only go with fact. When I testify in court, it's only what I found in the transcript. It's only what I found on the video. And there's these little things that people miss. Mm-hmm. I remember this one case, it was a sexual assault case. And they charged this 14, 15-year-old kid with sexual assault. And one of the things, when I looked at, and I went through the videos of his interview, and I went through his interrogation, I went through then the victim, who was a 12, 13-year-old kid. And the very last three lines, when she was asked, well, do you remember who it was that touched you? And she says, yeah, it was so-and-so, or it might have been my friend's brother year ago.
Yeah.
It was a dream.
Yeah.
But nobody saw that in the interview.
Well, you think sometimes, Brian, there's overzealous prosecutors. You know what I mean? I mean, they're getting a lot of pressure from, I'm a father. I don't know if you are, but you have kids and oh my God, something, happened to your kid. You want somebody to pay for it. Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the problem too, is we got these because I saw it in my law enforcement career where, these overzealous DAs are like, okay, well, we have to believe this kid.
Yeah. We have to believe him. Even though there's enough flags going up, that you shouldn't be believing them without corroboration.
Sure.
Sure. But nobody wants to question the victim anymore.
That's a great point. I mean, I've questioned victims before, but you bring up an excellent point, Brian, because mm-hmm. we don't want to, we can't re-victimize, quote, the victim by asking him questions, but you're exactly right. Why aren't we asking the victims, why aren't we talking to them more than we are?
Sure, absolutely. And you know why? Why that's important? We always say that, we don't want to re-victimize. We don't want to do this. Who do you think is going to jail for 30 years.
Sure.
If they're convicted, that's a death sentence.
Mm-hmm. Especially somebody who, as you know, like a child offender, you know, sure. somebody who has been accused
Absolutely.
Of that.
So the question is with that, why shouldn't we be exactly. vetting more?
Exactly. Now, what you brought up interview and interrogation. For those people, most people who are listening probably know the difference. For those who are not listening, what is the difference between an interview and an interrogation?
Well, an interview traditionally is non-accusatory in nature, mm-hmm. and the purpose is to gather information during an investigative process. Whereas an interrogation, the presumption of guilt, and the best way to understand an interrogation is that if you baked a cake and it was baked, you put the icing on it. That's the interrogation. That's what it's put. The presumption of guilt should have been met already but through investigative method. And so the interrogation purpose is to just get a confession. But if you put icing on a cake that hasn't been quite baked, that doesn't work. And that's where you have the flaw.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, involves persuasive techniques. It's accusatory in nature. That's an interrogation. It's always done in a controlled environment, or at least it should, in an interrogation room should be. And you're usually within 2 feet of the person's personal space. You're not taking notes. There's usually a beginning of an interrogation that you're beginning to do a rapport building where you're taking notes, getting information. That's done, ultimately notes being taken. Then you move into the position in the interrogation where you're in the person's personal space. So it's usually 2 seats, face to face, and that person's personal space is being invaded by you.
Now, is there a common theme, you've done thousands mm-hmm. of interviews, you've reviewed thousands of tape and footage of the interview mm-hmm. And interrogation. Is there one common theme or a reoccurring constant thing you see that police are screwing up or they're doing wrong?
Yeah, they don't set the pre-questions. In other mm-hmm. words, one of the things that most of these get overturned on is number one. First of all, it depends on the state. I love the states where they go in and they Mirandize them right away. Okay? Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Okay, he's a person of interest. You're pretending he's a witness because you don't want him getting scared and not giving you anything. You don't want him lawyering up right away. I get that. But here's the problem. You bring somebody in under the pretense that they're just helping your investigation. It's like doing a search in a trunk without a warrant when you have some other grounds to perhaps get him to pop the trunk, but whoa, you didn't see the pound of heroin in there. Now all of a sudden you need a warrant.
Yeah.
Big problem. But if you'd gone in the car, and we all know as officers, I go back as an officer. If you give somebody the formal Miranda in the beginning, chances are they're going to forget they got it. And you're going to continue on into the interview room. Okay. Yeah. So why wouldn't you do that? You know how many cases that I've dealt with where all of a sudden Miranda was given in the sixth hour? The sixth hour? Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah, why are they waiting that long?
Well, because they really believe, and this is true, they really believe for the most part that they're still a witness. They believe in their mind, the officers believe that they're treating this person as a detainee and he's just going to be released shortly. That's not the case. The fact of the matter is, this guy was a person of interest. He's a suspect. You know what? Miranda is. I have some states that are extremely good at that. And I think one of them is, I'm going to say Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys, they bring the guy in as a witness. They know he's going to be a suspect. Eventually, they Mirandize him. Perfect.
What harm does it do? It
doesn't. The problem is they're afraid if they don't Mirandize him, the guy's not going to want to talk to them. That's
well, I remember learning that, and then years ago they ingrained that in the academy, saying, "Well, psychologically, when somebody hears, Miranda being read to them, they're going to clam up."
Yeah, and that's not true at all. If you think about, I deal with primarily homicides and primarily sex offense cases. Mm-hmm. I can say 87% of my cases are homicides, and the rest sex offense cases. And I'm going to tell you right now that when you have an officer that takes somebody into the room and they build the rapport in the beginning, and if they have done their homework, if they've done dotted the I's and crossed the T's, they've got the physical evidence, they've got all the other evidence that they need to go, it's the icing you're putting there. Mm-hmm. You're saying to him, look, I'm going to just tell you right now what we have. You tell me if you want, and I've got to tell you, you know, anything you say may be used as evidence, that you're going to tell me what you want me to know. Mm-hmm. You know what, these guys, a lot of the time, they will. But when you go in with the idea that you haven't dotted the I's, you didn't cross the T's, now this guy is saying, well, I didn't do anything. And you're saying, I just want to know the truth. It's not the truth, it's your truth.
Yeah.
Because you didn't do your investigation properly. And had you done that, had you done the proper ID, had you vetted your witness, going back to the very beginning, had you done the witness, vetted of the witness, that witness would have told you in the dominant witness theory that no, I didn't really see anything. But you based everything on what you wanted to hear. That's what you took the statement on. And that's what you're now going to the interrogation room. And he's denying everything because he probably didn't do it. And if I'm wrong about that, then you explain to me why we have all these exonerations.
Yeah.
And most of them, 25% according to the Innocence Project, are confessions. I can tell you there's one state, I wanted to say what state it is. This guy known for, and he's got a reputation, officer, and I deal with probably have crossed his cases a couple of times now in a different state. I won't say which state. And he's known as the king of confessions. He never video records, never audio records, they never write anything down. He writes it.
Oh, that's a big problem. Come on.
And his whole career has been doing this.
Wow. And nobody's called him on that? No DA? No, nobody has called him on that?
Well, I'm sure they've challenged it. But I mean, it's like when I see that, I'm going to myself, hire me.
Exactly.
Please, please hire me.
Wow. Now, what is...
I have a real problem with that.
I do too. I mean, you're not recording it. You're the one doing the writing.
Yeah.
There's no recording or anything in there? I mean, come on.
Exactly.
I'm going to pick on Texas. I got to say, is it in Texas, Brian?
No, I'm not going to say.
God, that's, yeah, I don't think that would, well, at least where I was from, where I did my career, wouldn't fly.
No, it wouldn't. And anything short of that shouldn't fly either. And this is what I'm saying. What happens is people get on the same path. And you know what it's like with DAs and ADAs is that when you are working with them, they want to work with the police. They don't want to shut the police down, okay? They don't want to be the police enemy. So they're going to look the other way on certain things that maybe they should be looking at because they have an ethical issue there. Mm-hmm. But we all know through working with, you know, prosecutors and as police officers, you've taken liberties perhaps. Maybe you didn't, you were off on a night shift that night and you didn't cross your T's and dot your I's. And you're just hoping to fly by the seat of your pants in the court. And they're just kind of looking the other way as well. These are things that shouldn't be done. They should be called out on. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we all as officers, and let's face it, we get to the point where we're so busy, we take so many cases, and then we're going from one call to another, one investigation, another, you have your diary dates and everything else. And you're literally to a point where, you know what, I want to talk to this witness, but I can only do it for 30 minutes. I got to be somewhere else.
Yeah, and you rush it.
The rushing issue is not their fault. They are a product of that, and that translates into the interrogation room. Mm-hmm. That's
and bad confessions or confessions from people who didn't do anything.
Absolutely.
Not Mirandizing people.
Sure. No, not Mirandizing. I mean, the simple ones. For example, one of my favorite is the blackout confession.
Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, so we go into the blackout confession. It's when you're in your rapport building, as we all know with officers, we try to build the rapport, get the guy comfortable with us. And one of the things that, you know, you're talking about, the guy's an alcoholic, you know, he's a drug user. And so the first thing you're saying to him, you know, I used to I used to party a lot when I was younger. How about you? Even if you didn't, you're going to lie about it and say you did, because he's going to come on. In fact, there's books published on themes, and I'm not going to say who publishes them, but that on that exact theme where they take training in this. And you're going to say to them, look, you know, after about an hour of you guys are bonding, it's really great. And he's telling you stories about when he passed out after, you know, won a big drunken brawl that night. And you're going to make up some stuff because you were the goody two shoes. You were actually a nerd when you were younger. And so you're going to pretend that you actually did this stuff. So, and so then eventually you say to the guy an hour and a half, 2 hours into the thing, you know, Bob, is it possible that when you did that, that you might have been passed out? You might have been blacked out. I mean, I understand that. That can happen. And it's not really your fault. You just blacked out. And then eventually he'll say, no, I don't think so. I don't. And then it'll eventually be, yeah, you know what? Maybe you're right. Yeah, I think that's maybe what happened. That's the narrative integration. That's what the narrative integration is. When you're integrating a narrative into a vulnerable individual, that becomes a problem. And that's why a lot of these ones get kicked. You know, when I go to suppression hearing, these are simple, simple things they shouldn't be doing, because they're going to get kicked.
Well, why is this stuff getting still taught, Brian? I mean,
you know what? Well,
because this is training. This is training. Comes down to training, yeah, right?
I won't say who the biggest trainer is, but we all know who it is.
Well, it's probably Reed and Wicklander and stuff like that.
Yeah, and those in a press release they had put out that they're no longer teaching that. Not that it, and you know what? I'm in fairness of that. I'm going to say this, and everybody would think that, oh, I'm definitely against the Reed tech. I'm not. What I'm against is abusing it.
Yeah,
that's what I'm against. Because when you abuse it and take liberties in areas that you shouldn't be taking liberties in, that's not what's meant for. It's like we all know in policing policy. We all know when we go to policy, we know, hey, we're cops. We can take liberties. Let's figure out how to get around these policies. Cops are notorious for that.
Yeah.
We're notorious for that. Let's figure out how I can make my shift a lot easier. Let's figure out what I don't need to do with paperwork.
Yep.
And then when we don't want to do it, our unions don't let us do it either. So we all know this. So it's a question of saying, you know what, what's right, what's wrong? You know, take liberty. Don't pretend certain things are happening when they're not. Don't pretend you have evidence. And you can call, like I say, you can call a skunk, or you can call it a porcupine. It's still a skunk.
Yeah. And I was always taught, Brian, you know, coming up in law enforcement and getting back to that, you know, rushed kind of mindset that a lot of cops have, and okay, we'll just do a half-assed job here and then we'll go to the next one. Mm-hmm. I was always taught that it's not about quantity. Mm-hmm. It's about quality, yeah, right? Because you get that reputation as that guy, the interrogation king that doesn't record anything,
yeah.
You know, and you get that reputation among DAs.
It's an ego.
It's an ego thing, but it comes down to a trust thing too.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
A credibility issue.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And these are the things that a lot of officers need to re-identify. And if you, for example, if you really understood your community well, the officers that really are involved in their communities and know everybody and take have a good understanding of their dynamics of their community they know how to deal with the people. They're getting proper information because that's trusted information.
Yeah.
And when they vet that information, they can vet it through the people they already know.
Yeah.
They know it's good. They already know what's going on in their community. So the bottom line is, it's just a question of crossing your T's and dotting your I's.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the ones that make the mistakes, the same old ones over and over. I remember this one, and I'm not going to say what state again. And it's not.
Yeah,
it's
so not, you've been all over the place.
And it's not, oh, I do, I've done 44 of the 50 states. And I'll tell you, I remember this in a deposition of all things prior to going into a trial. This one officer, and is a state police, and he says, when he's asked, well, what evidence did you have to, you know, to investigate my client? And he says, I had a gut feeling. well, let's all shut down now. We had a gut feeling.
Geez.
You know, we know what the answer is. I mean, so. I mean, that's so blatant it is. I believe that when I looked at a transcript of that, I said, whoa, this guy believed that in fact he was doing the right thing, that he could tell right from wrong. He could tell he was a lie detector.
But it's okay to have that feeling. You just don't want to.
But yeah, it's okay to have that feeling. But what you might want to do is actually find corroborating evidence.
Exactly. Because a gut feeling is not PC. Yeah,
absolutely. You know?
Now, what other techniques, talk about it for a few minutes, Brian. Sure, what other techniques are used when police get somebody in the interrogation room and they want to get a targeted confession?
Perfect. Okay. So you're going to use minimization, which simply is basically the interview minimizes the culpability. My favorite one in this one is, and I'm not going to say once again which federal department does it, but one of the things that's done in the interrogation room is I know this has been done more than probably 8 times I've already seen, where they go into the idea it's a sexual assault, but it's not a child assault of any kind. It's just it's a consensual issue, and you know, she said, he said, you know, it was passionate night. She said no. She said stop. He stopped. And so what happens is they get into this, well, look at, you know what, it's murder's way up here. What you did is way down here. And then they'll go on further and say, well, I tell you what I'm going to do. All she really wants you to do is admit you're wrong. And that I know you guys all want to be friends. You're all part of the same circle. And to keep your credibility in that circle, all she wants you to do is admit you did it and then apologize for it. And I'm going to leave you in here for about 20, 30 minutes. And you just, here's a paper, here's a pen. And you watch the video, the guy's in tears because he didn't do anything.
Sure.
But he does it because he feels that's going to get him off. That'll all be done and forgotten about.
Wow. Well, coercive.
Yeah, it's confession.
Yeah.
The second thing is maximization, overstating the case, you know. Maximizing, saying, you know, telling the story about, you know, I know this guy, yes, last week he came in here and, you know, he was charged with this and that. And he had, you know, the guy told me the truth. He told me what it was. And, you know, when he got in court, you know, he got out a real light sentence. And you're not saying you're promising him anything. You're just telling a story. You're just telling a story. And there's books published on this, how to do this. So these are training manuals. And the issue then is you're maximizing it. You're telling him. And so the person feeling like, you know, this officer's not believing anything he's talking about. He's not believing anything he's saying that happened. He says, I don't want to hear that. I want to hear the truth. Well, the truth is your truth, not the real truth, because your evidence doesn't match or even corroborate with the facts. The second, you know, then you talk about, you know, and I've talked about inductive, deductive, but in, you know, narrative integration, for example, is another one. Narrative integration, like I already said, is where you're integrating a narrative into the individual. You're very suggestive in the way you're talking about it. Mm-hmm. You're suggesting that this has happened and that happened. And a lot of times, if you talk fast enough, and a lot of times this is done, they don't hear the actual question, and that becomes the narrative trap. The narrative trap is one that I always go after, because it's a constructed question that no matter how you answer it, it's all going to be incriminating. And that's done a lot in, I've seen that done quite a bit. I've done a lot of baby deaths. And what you find was you have a perfectly good family that is in there, the husband, wife, their newborn infant has died. They are traumatized by this. The police want them to come in and talk to them. And they were more than happy to come in. They don't talk to a lawyer. There's no need to. They don't feel that they've had done anything wrong. And as you start seeing, and I'll just kind of go over one particular case. I'm not going to say where it was or how it was, mm-hmm. but the interviewer starts off by saying, you know what? So when you grabbed the child and took him to the sink, was he vomiting? Yeah. So when you were running with the child, you must have been shaken a little bit, right? Yeah, but no more than 5 times. And then by the time an hour, 2 hours could pass, well, it's no more than 10 times. Well, they're
there you go.
They're creating a narrative for shaken baby syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
To become incriminating. And this guy has no intent to do anything. The child was vomiting. He grabbed the child and took it to the sink so the child could vomit.
Well, like you said, he's traumatized. Him and the wife are traumatized. And absolutely. It's almost like the cops are taking advantage of that.
Yeah, and he doesn't know where the thing's going either. He has no idea that he's actually targeted as a person of interest.
And by then, after they've gotten essentially a confession, you know, by the time he realizes what's going on, or, you know, he's going to lawyer up, and by then the confession's already made.
Yeah, yeah. Another one I always update my definition sections of my of my reports only when I find new stuff. And there's another one that basically is, I'd never seen this before, but I saw it this one time where it was a child sex abuse case where this guy had been charged. He was in his early 20s, and these were cousins or something. From before. And what happened was it was a female officer that, you know, had a kind of a more of a motherly type, compassionate tone to her. Mm-hmm. And he felt that he could talk to her about his sex abuse case. And she said, well, yes, you can. And then made the one comment in the interview that had the thing suppressed almost immediately was she said to him, well, I tell you what, I'll listen to your side if you admit to all the other ones.
Oh, God.
I thought to myself, what are you talking about?
Jeez.
Oh, like, you didn't see anything wrong with this?
My God. Well, and the thing is that that person was taught how to do that by somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, that's learned behavior.
Or they've never been caught doing it.
Probably both.
Yeah, they've never been had it suppressed on that basis. That's probably what's happened.
And think of how many cases, Brian, I don't have to tell you. Think of how many cases
Just so you get an idea how many cases, and that's just myself only, I get probably 4 or 5 phone calls a day.
Jeez. Of
cases that are, I would say, based on the stories, some of them I do, some of them I don't. But, I mean, they all fit into one kind of pattern.
Now, I know you do a lot of work for the defense, but do you ever, do law enforcement agencies, because you're all over the place, you're an expert.
Yeah.
You wrote the book, you wrote tons of books, so I want to talk about real quick. Do you ever get asked by police, look, Brian, can you come into the agency and teach our officers what not to do?
I have reached out to police departments. I'd be more than happy to. I wouldn't even charge them for it.
Because you're like, I mean, you got the law enforcement background.
Yeah.
You know, you're an expert. But it's like, why aren't people asking Brian Leslie to go come in here? I would, if I was still in the force, say, Brian, come on, we'll pay you.
You know what? Well, you know what? It's a simple matter of, you know what? There's certain things you're doing. Why don't you prevent it from happening so you don't lose a murder case in suppression?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't make sense. I mean, I'm on the media a lot. So, you know, I'm there. Nobody ever calls me from police departments. I've actually reached out to a few just to see if there's an interest there.
Yeah.
I never get a call back.
Wow.
And really, the conversation can be very quick. What it can simply say is, look, what are we doing wrong? What can we do to stop, to save cases from getting suppressed on the confession side? Why would you want to go through a suppression hearing when the reason why defense gets a hold of myself is because they have an obvious situation. If it's that obvious, and by the time I get it, it's pretty much obvious that there's so much, and when I get it, I find like 8 or 9 more things. But I mean, even at the legal side, the lawyers are finding it's not adding up. And so my thing is, I love to teach and show and share, not teach, but share to police departments what they need to do so these don't get suppressed.
Well, I think some of it is, you probably know, and I'm just spitballing, Ryan, but I think we both have law enforcement backgrounds. It's ego.
Absolutely.
It's like, oh, shit, we don't want to bring this guy in. You know, who's he going to tell us?
Yeah, who's going to tell us what to do?
Yeah, tell us what to do.
Yeah, we have experts on our department.
Now talk about
experts, Those are the experts that are in the interrogation room that they're getting suppressed.
Now, talk about the three books you have, brother, really quick.
All right. Well, I mean, I have one of them called Deception of a Witness. I have another one, Visual Liar and Reaction Analysis Profiling. Now, Reaction Analysis Profiling was the original one because what I did was, when I was a cop, one of the things I just couldn't bear was the idea of witnesses. I just had a real problem with believing witnesses all the time. And so I developed through probably three years worth, I developed a methodology called Reaction Analysis Profiling, where I'm patterning body language uniquely to the individual. So it's like taking a polygraph, except for you're using body language. You're using the eyes, the mouth, and the head tilt. And I've proven this over and over again. And one of the issues that I did with that was I developed some baseline questions, because what people don't realize is body language is unique like DNA is. Mm-hmm. You have to pattern it. You have to know what that individual, because everybody's different. So everybody's not going to look up left to the left and it means the same thing. So what you need to do is you need to ask five questions of, you know, the truth, that you know that's going to be the truth, five questions that are subjective, and three questions that are are going to be lied about. That's how you set your baseline. Then from there, you already know what the moves are in certain tells in the thing. That's what I did. And I used it in witnesses. I didn't use an accused. I used it in witnesses. And you wouldn't believe how many times after I had found that there were suspicious elements in certain witnesses, mm-hmm. that I then re-questioned them or got other evidence and proved that they were totally lying. And they admitted to totally lying. Jeez. But I would never have found that out had I not had that methodology I used. And I would have just taken their statement. I would have accepted them. They were perfectly legitimate bank manager type people and that's the other thing that cops need to stop doing. It's just because the guy's got a good job doesn't mean he's not a liar.
Well, the bank manager wouldn't lie to us.
Yeah, absolutely. you know, and I always tell the story of, you know, if you went up and you went, let's say, for instance, I was a bank manager and I said to myself, look, my neighbor, I can't stand. I'm going to have him set up. And I go out and I'm this well-going guy in a suit and everything else. And I call the police in the morning and I say, look, this guy's walking through my yard at night. I think he took my lawnmower. And meanwhile, I had set his lawnmower up in his shed. And then the officer said, really? Oh yeah. Yeah. I saw him out there. And you know, you're a legitimate guy. Why would you lie? You have a good job. People with good jobs don't lie. Right. So then the officer goes to the other guy. And of course now he's going to be, because we all believe as officers that the first impression is this guy can't be lying. He's so detailed about what he's doing. So he goes to the bank manager, or he goes to the next door neighbor and says, hey, look, there's an allegation that you were walking in this guy's yard. Well, no, I wasn't. Well, can we check? Can we go into your shed? Oh yeah, go ahead. Go in there. The lawnmower's in there. Now you're in possession of property. But you would always believe that this was a legitimate case because you believe the bank manager because he has a good job and he's dresses in a suit.
Yeah. Good point.
That's why. It's a predisposition. You just, as soon as the other guy, you talk to him, he's got a real attitude, and right away you've pegged him in as a potential suspect.
Yeah. Now, Brian, where can people find these books if they want to get them?
You can go online. You can go online.
Amazon or?
Yeah, they're pretty much everywhere. Just type in the title and you can get any of them. Just Visual Liar, Deception of a Witness. If you type in you'll get them in everywhere, Barnes & Noble, everywhere.
Well, Brian Leslie. Sir, if people want to reach out to you, and I hope they do, for all you law enforcement, maybe upper echelon kind of people within agencies, you really need to take Brian up on his offer of coming in my opinion, and helping the troops kind of, not that we're slamming officers, it's not, but we want to make you better.
Look, we will do it by Zoom.
Brian, where can they find you, brother? What's your website?
Okay, it's coerciveinterrogationexpert.com.
Well, Brian Leslie, thank you so much, sir. It has been an education. Thank you much for your expertise, your dedicated service, and the continued great work that you do today.
Do you know someone with a drug or alcohol problem? Get help right now. Insurance may cover everything. Stop the drug and alcohol nightmare. Are drug and alcohol problems hitting you too close to home? Get help right now. Insurance may cover everything.
800-210-7907. 800-210-7907. 800-210-7907. That's 800-210-7907.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.